Hello, 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 everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of This Anthropological Life. As always, I'm Anil Tripathi.
And I'm Adam Gamwell.
And so today we're diving right into transforming access. So, you know, recently there was an event at the Boston Society of Architects with Gabe Klein, someone who's worked in numerous transportation departments from D.C. to Chicago, trying to think about ways to change transportation space, you know, putting in bike paths where there used to be roads, putting in greenways where there used to be highways. But on the way to the event, kind of, I saw a curious thing. I got out of South Station and I was walking down the parkway and I went right across Dewey Square, which is actually where Occupy Boston was located. That was the main locus point where all the tents were set up and everyone was camping out. And I noticed when I was walking by it that it was actually the site of a Shock Top Beer Fest. So this is kind of a big celebration, you know, very corporate Shock Top logos everywhere with a nice band stage and whatnot. But it meant, I mean, it really got me to think about just how drastic a change this seems to be from the Occupy Boston protest to this. And yet it's the same space, right? So it seemed, you know, in all the space around us, right, there are almost infinite possibilities of its use. And over time, we just see these transformations, right, which are just so fascinating in their development.
Yeah, and that's it's sort of, I think it's a great sort of segue to think about what brought us to this episode, you know. So, you know, even harkening back a couple weeks ago to our show on World Cup, right, and this raised questions of access. And so, you know, that kind of inspired sort of a more general thinking process of, you know, what does it mean to have access to certain kinds of spaces and who has the right to use the space, who has the right to change that space. And so when we were kind of conceiving the episode, we were thinking about ways that space changes over time, the way that people may change space. And so I think what you point out, Neil, is this really interesting idea that, like, this the same space, Dewey Square in this case in Boston, which was inspired by Zuccotti Park in New York in Lower Manhattan for where Occupy Wall Street took place. But then now on top of that, we're seeing a beer fest in the same kind of space. And so it's this notion of, like, publics and private spaces we can kind of dive into and think about what the heck is going on with in terms of, like, how do people have access to space, right? And who has the choice to make these things accessible or not?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
And also with this, right, we see so many different kind of modes of development, right, or different styles. You have, of course, Gabe Klein was working with the Department of Transportation, so it was kind of a top-down thing, even though, of course, you know, they're trying to get involved with local community organizers. But of course, you know, it's still within the government kind of going down. And so I think the issue, right, of who gets to determine how a space will be changed is so important. Yeah. Because in all of any debate of a change of a landscape, of course, there are numerous voices, but not every voice gets heard equally.
Absolutely, right. I mean, even simple cases that we can think about, like guerrilla gardening, right, in that terms of where it's just sort of these you know, and guerrilla, of course, is taken from like the notions of sort of insurgent militant groups in Central and South America at different times during the 20th century, and the notion that these are non-professional soldiers in this way. So when you add the word gardening to that, it adds this really funky idea of you know, throwing wild seeds out in these in little, you know, if you're walking down the sidewalk and you know, it's of course a lot of cement, and then there'll be a little space for a tree with some dirt, you know, you'll see people sometimes throw gardening things there or try to do some sort of urban gardening in terms of whether it's wildflowers or if it's vegetables or whatever. But again, this recognition that space is used a certain way, but then other people, as you're saying, there's different kind of voices saying, well, this space should actually be used in some ways for gardening, or at least raising awareness that there is other ways of using this space.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Completely. And of course, you might actually get in trouble, right, if you're throwing seeds in different places.
I usually, mean,
if you're clearing any kind of cement that was laid down by a city or a town, that's town property, right? So if you remove cement or even grow anything there, you're actually going against property lines. Mm. I know in Los Angeles with the kind of gardening movement there, a lot of people have run into trouble with the local governments. When they're putting seeds on, you know, in the space between the sidewalk and the road, because that's seen as town property, even though it's being, you know, totally unused or, you know, a real kind of blight on the eyes.
Yeah, that's a question too. I mean, and you mentioned blight there, so there is this important question too of aesthetics, right? And that's also kind of what gardening gets us towards. But also, we can think about big projects in Boston here, like the Big Dig that, you know, took 10 years, $10 billion. A lot of people said it was a huge, some people are for it, some people say it's a huge waste of money. Other people say it's a great idea because it moved Interstate 90 underground. And then, you know, of course, on top of that, made a nice sort of open green park space that, that sort of accentuates and creates a nice border between, you know, downtown Boston and the North End. And so even that, again, these questions of aesthetics and in some ways morality too, of what's the right way to use a kind of space, you know, and particularly when we're talking about an urban space, the two examples we brought so far in Boston, like what does it mean in terms of, you know, what can we be having, you know, what can we put in these spaces? I think another piece that, that struck me, I do want to dive into Paul Klein here in a second, or Greg Klein, Gabe Klein, sorry. Thinking of Paul Fallon, the other architect I was thinking of. But something that, again, Paul Fallon had an interesting piece with Cognoscenti, too, that was talking about what kind of legacies do we want to leave behind when we think about space. And so he was doing kind of a walking tour with a friend in Mount Auburn Cemetery here in Boston. And one of the things that he points out is that it seems like this area has been this way for a long time. And even the way he describes it are actually the features that you might think of from a receding glacier. In different ways, you're going to see ebbs and flows in the land. There may be a cut in the land that you'd see that, you know, if ice was moving in a certain direction, you'd see it sort of cut the ground this way. And the notion of temporality there shows up because it's a slowly moving glacier, right? You may think about why do we see certain hills or hillocks or trees here or there. And that it seems like this is, you know, this natural, beautiful place. But what he points out is that this is intentionally designed to look this way. Actually, the same with Central Park in New York, as well as in a Boston Common here in Boston. Like, these are very intentionally designed spaces that have subways under them, for one. Mm-hmm. So clearly it's not just this purely untouched space, right?
Oh, yeah.
But this question of, like, how do you use space in certain ways like that, right? And what does it mean to then put a green space over subway tunnels?
That's true. It seems that there are certain figures on landscape that seem to connote oldness, right, or kind of naturalness. Right. I mean, I know in Central Park there's a lot of very rocky areas with trees kind of growing over and everything. So it makes it seem that it's been there for a very long time.
Right.
Right. It was also this idea of in the cemetery. I know, you know, for myself, it always, a cemetery kind of evokes these certain images, right? The very large oak trees.
Right.
And whatnot. And then if you see a new cemetery, it seems almost kind of a big contrast, right? Because you have these small trees and, you know, it's, you know, just freshly made and everything.
Well, even, I mean, the other place that we tend to see large trees are universities, right? I mean, you see them in lots of places. But the two places you may think of, these big oak trees, right, are usually cemeteries and universities. And when that feature is lacking, it does sort of raise these flags of there's something wrong with this space, which then tells us, I mean, it's not that, you know, putting a grave near a tree is a natural thing, but that's sort of a way we've learned to think about space being used that involves graves or in a university setting, right? If you don't have the big oak tree,
And also the ivy, right?
The ivy, too,
Ivy League. You need, you know, some ivy on the buildings.
Right.
And I think this idea of this timelessness, right, is incredibly important, especially with regards to transportation and different modes of transport. Gabe Klein brought up, you know, how so much of the U.S. was connected by trolleys and different cable car systems. I know I have some friends out who live a ways out of Providence in Rhode Island, and 100 years ago, 80 years ago even, there was a cable car that they could take from that rural area, you know, farmland into Providence, right, into the city. And we did have a huge amount of infrastructure around the U.S. that we've laid to waste almost because we were too good at one form of access. We were too good at making cars and, you know, propelling that industry. And it's left a huge effect. And then thinking about how we should, you know, change the situation, how can we provide better access for our communities? A lot of these debates then raise voices which, you know, come on an unequal axis. So if we talk about trying to create increased connectivity within our urban spaces and we try to focus on transportation corridors, you know, such as what they're doing in Somerville, extending the Green Line out there, they want to make more residential area right around those stations. They want to concentrate their growth. But then where does that leave people living in rural areas? You know, what is the new form of transportation for them? What are we going to do to provide them some access? Or is all the federal money or all the state money going to go to these urban projects?
Right. And that's it's a great question. We'll dive into this next week because we're going to go into urban cycling from here. But you're right. Really great questions you raise here, Neil, about what voices get to be told and heard sort of in what forms too, right? Again, because if we're talking about public transportation in this capacity, or even changing how space is going to be used or who has access to this kind of space. Again, a simple example, right, is that should we put bike lanes somewhere in the city, you know, or should it just be a car-based space? And then Gabe Klein ran into this problem in Chicago, right? And that was one of his big pushes, was to sort of have, which is really, I think, a cool idea, this notion of having a complete streets, right? And that a street is not just about cars or even just pedestrians, but again, there's multiple modes of transportation that people could use. You know, for whatever reason, which you can think about it, he's like, this is seen as a progressive way of thinking about things by having a road that does more than just cars or people. And so, you know, whether we can progressive is a different political question for later. But the idea of how do we have these, what a complete street look like, and who has access to then say, I think we should or should not have these kinds of things. And there was this kind of debate between Klein and the National Motorists Association that was kind of like, well, he's anti-car, so we don't like him at all, which is, again, very polemical and it's not good dialogue. But again, who has access here? We're talking about the national sort of, you know, automobile industry, which is different from then, you know, your average citizens walking down the street, even though it may be made up of them. Mm-hmm. And then we have Gabe Klein, who just had a high-profile sort of government-centered from D.C. to Chicago, back to D.C. again, architect. You know, so it's like this very interesting idea of who gets to say what. You know, and so, of course, it's always happy when one political side feels the advantage of, you know, the top dog saying, all right, we're going to do something that you want to see happen. You know, that's a nice thing. Mm-hmm. But it does raise this question, too, even about representative democracy, right? And that's a bit of an abstract idea, but it is important to think about, as you said, like, who has access to even talk at these forums, right?
Oh, yeah. And there's so many different types of access, right? I mean, in any kind of a space, you know, the people who have access to it are determined by a numerous number of things, right? You might be living right next to a park, but maybe you have a full-time job. You don't have access to that park.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, you have to be working to pay the rent on your apartment that's right next to that park. So you might not be able to really have access to it, even though it seems like, you know, out of free will and whatnot, you should be able to go walk there whenever you want.
Absolutely, yeah.
But we see this, I think, all the time. I mean, in the center of urban cities, especially I found in the very wealthy areas, there are lots of free events and, you know, free discussions, you know, open kind of public initiatives. But then to get to all these things, you need to have the free time.
Right.
And you need to have the money to, you know, transport into the center.
Yeah, so. It's a great point. I mean, it kind of goes back to urban theorist Jane Jacobs, who is kind of really big in transforming how we think about urban spaces and cities. And one of the things that she pointed out is this notion of having eyes on the street. And this is, I think it was in is the Life and Death of Great American Cities, or the Death and Life of Great American Cities. I forget what the order of the title is. But what she points out is this notion of eyes on the street. And it's kind of, again, how street space should be accessed. And so what she found is that the most secure neighborhoods were ones that typically had people that were kind of always hanging out on the streets and shop fronts. You know, tens of people tend to know each other that way too, because you're talking, you know, in common spaces, and that the street became a common space. Now, this is pre-1950, and so one of the big pushes that we came with, like, this, you know, the urban sort of nuclear family development of the 50s, if you know anything about United States history, is that there's, again, the push to sort of a single family home, right? And that we need to, you know, have your 2.5 kids and your dog and your white picket fence. Now, the traditional American dream, which ironically is only about 60 years old, you know, but the idea is, you know, and it died quite soon after that. But the idea is, like, that lingers in our thoughts. But what Jacobs found sort of in the urban spaces before that was, again, the opposite. And that actually it's not safer if people are always in their homes by themselves. And, like, the space is then restricted to, you know, the single family home is the domestic house space, right? But then really she says that safe cities are when people are hanging out in the streets, you know? And of course we think of, oh, kids on the street, that's not a safe thing now. Like, this, the mentality is sort of pushed away from this. And again, it supports the urban development of, you know, single family dwellings.
Oh, yeah.
But again, Jacobs found the complete opposite to be the case, right?
And that can even lead to a more breakdown of community, right? When you're trying to really focus just on the nuclear family and having it have separation and space.
Absolutely,
from the communities around it. One interesting thing to bring up with this is, you know, kind of the antithesis of Jane Jacobs, Robert Moses, who was a huge, you know, planner, a master builder back in the 50s and 40s and 30s in New York, right? And he, talk about top down, I mean, he was able to get massive amounts of federal money to go to building the highways in New York. And he built the highways up Long Island, all of the big thoroughways through New York City. Mm-hmm. So, you know, talking about someone who's transformed access, I mean, it's definitely Robert Moses, right? He built up so many of these highways, and Jane Jacobs even protested against a lot of his developments.
Right.
But then, you know, just because he was in a position of power, he had tremendous influence, and right. he could even write state bonds himself, and get the money to fund these projects.
So, that's interesting.
With that much power, you know, he could move a lot of stuff, and he did other things too. I mean, he's probably the reason why the United Nations is in New York City. And also set up several world fairs. So I think really with all this, it's such a big issue, right? Who is in power and who has access to the funds to really, you know, change these spaces and change the types of access in these spaces.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, you point to an interesting idea there, Neil, that the financial aspect is, you know, totally important to how we're seeing these systems develop, right? And again, as you said, Robert Moses in a position of political power, but as well as too, he had the financial resources to sort of make his visions come to fruition, right? And then again, that was just a cutting of expressway through the Bronx, you know, which totally isolated a lot of communities, right, and shattered them in some ways, which is a tough thing, you know. But you're right, the economic aspect is hugely important here again. And we do need to think about, we're trying to dig into here, is like, is there a way to sort of ensure that more voices can be placed into these kinds of spaces? And that's the perennial political question anyway, the democratic question, right? How do as many voices have access to the seats of influence as possible? And in what ways can that happen? I mean, you'll even see, you know, we see notions of you know, the U.S. Congress, like, reserving specific seats for Native Americans or Latinos or something, right? And that's an important step, but again, also it doesn't change the fundamental system of power, right?
Oh, completely. And I think so much of these issues of access to political expression and a voice in various development projects, I think it's so important how these measures are framed. For instance, in the U.S., you know, we have a big housing culture, and housing, you know, is definitely a certain form of space. And so much of private housing ownership was actually so heavily subsidized by the public, you know, by the government itself. Mm-hmm. You think about lower interest mortgages, and even Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, right? These were public organizations that then funded people, subsidized private home ownership. And yet people who own their homes themselves, we don't say, oh, you're taking out a government handout. But people who live in subsidized housing somehow are inferior because they're living off the government.
Yeah.
Right. So you have, I think it's very important to think about how the inclusion is framed and, you know, who's given agency within this. Right. So private homeowners are seen as more industrious, harder working, building value. You know, having their own property, whereas people living in subsidized housing and government-funded projects are then seen as, you know, not having the kind of the energy or the agency to really do anything.
Yeah, and that's a really fascinating kind of observation you're putting out there. And it does, I mean, it harkens back to Max Weber's book on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, right? And that Benjamin Franklin famously said, which, you know, we may not go to Benjamin Franklin too much for thinking now, but it's a wonderful phrase that whether or not you're actually working at 5 a.m., it's better to get out there and have your hammer hitting on something at 5 a.m. so it sounds like you're working, so people think you're working. Therefore, they're more likely to lend you credit so you can, you know, get income to go do something. And so this really kind of funny but quietly insidious and sarcastic idea, right, that as long as it looks like you're working, it's better. But again, that sort of builds into this notion of the Protestant ethic. We won't dive too much into this right now, but just again, this push that there's a certain ethic of that you need to be, you know, we have to be an industriousness and a workingness, right? That filters into the religious idea that came from Calvinism, that, you know, in a lot of part of Protestant Calvinism was that, you know, if you're either chosen for, you know, predestination for heaven or for hell, and God already chose it before you were born. One of the ways, like, you know, how would you tell that? And so one of the ideas that kind of came out, even Franklin too, is that, like, if you're industrious and you're doing well and you're rewarded financially, then therefore you it might be a sign of being in God's favor. So this really interesting theological idea that was tied into sort of how people are you know, milling about and making their days happen, right? And so then on top of that, we now see, like, this is like this interesting genealogy, if we just follow it to what you just said, right? There's still this idea that if you're living in a certain kind of, like, if you're not financially well off, somehow you're doing something wrong. Which, again, totally, this is a fabrication, right? This is a thinking process, and, like, Weber helped us put that into perspective, going all the way back to sort of the you know, colonial founding of the United States.
Oh yeah.
Really worth. I mean, again, it's just fun. It's fun to think about. But even, I mean, we can bring this right back to space too. And what kind of spaces? How can they be used? I mean, even returning to Occupy Wall Street in Boston, right? There's this interesting notion of private and public, of space,
exactly.
Right? And what is a public space used for, right? Can Zuccotti Park actually be used for protest, right? And of course, the answer is no. It can't be. Like, I mean, it became tolerated in some ways by the authorities because so many people were there.
Mm.
But there's arrests every day. I mean, if you ever watch any of the videos, I mean, there's tons of fascinating YouTube videos out there of just day in and day out of life on Occupy Wall Street.
Mm.
And I mean, really kind of cool stuff too. You'd see lawyers out there wearing yellow hats that just said pro bono or like, I'm a lawyer, talk to me if anybody harasses you. Right. They would be working there for free because they were supporting the idea of Occupy Wall Street, but also recognize that traditionally these people are in this line between public and private.
Oh yeah.
Right.
And with this comes so many issues of morality, right? So,
yeah.
So many of the quips going against the Occupy protesters where it's that, you know, get up and go get a job, right?
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing going back to the Protestant ethic,
right?
If you're just sitting around, you're not being productive. You know, it's
right.
Your fault that you're in the situation, whereas the rest of us are hard at work doing whatever we do.
Yeah, no, it's a great it's a great point. And yeah, I mean, the morality is really important. That it may not come up in your thinking process right away, right? But it's very true. There is, and that's kind of what we're bringing Weber up here, because like there is this morality that's in the idea that like, yeah, if you're doing Occupy Wall Street, that the famous quote, "Go get a job."
Mm.
Right. And I do remember on WBR, they a couple of years ago, they interviewed a young guy, I forget his name, but that he was doing Occupy Wall Street because he didn't have a job at the time. And then he got a job and he has a job that overlooked Zuccotti Park. And then it was so this moment of like he felt a little weird because he could, you know, he still supported the fact that they had the protest. But then at the same time, he's on the other side of the fence now. And so he felt that he couldn't comment, perhaps as honestly as, which he even said, which is interesting. Like, I can't really exactly say totally, but you know, you could see there's a dissension in the way he was kind of
almost,
thinking about
almost
it.
Because he's been given this extra access,
right?
Right, that it almost makes it disingenuine,
right?
That he can go back to the other place,
right?
And I think so much, you know, with the Occupy protests, same with Dewey Square, right? They're so close to the financial hubs. So you had this real contestation of space,
right?
Right, where you had finance professionals walking right next to the protesters. In a way, it almost relates to when you're bringing up with the Supreme Court cases, the abortion clinic or the Planned Parenthood clinics, and how the law was struck down, keeping protesters 35 feet away, and now they can get in closer, right? So there's so many issues of access to space. In any kind of a protest area or any kind of a political zone.
Yeah, that's actually a great example to bring back up, right? And that's the 35-foot ban was struck down so that protesters can now be essentially up in the faces of men and women that want to use Planned Parenthood services. And it's true, and again, that does raise the question of this, like, the public-private again, because it is a sidewalk. Like, there was, you know, if you go, I've been past it in Commonwealth Avenue, like, the Planned Parenthood has... there's a yellow line painted. That's the protest line, and that's not going to go anywhere. I mean, that's what's been there up until like last month. But it is great to think about because this public private space, right, is the sidewalk. What is that? You know, it's directly in front of the Planned Parenthood building. But is that public? Is that private? Of course, the Supreme Court rules that this is a public space. However, then what does that mean? Then the public space can be used for anything.
Oh,
right?
Well, yeah, that goes back to the kind of the guerrilla gardening, right? Because if it's public space on the sidewalk, right, why can't you just throw seeds? You know, why can't you just grow stuff there?
Right.
And then it can be free game for anyone. Anyone who wants to pick some broccoli can just go get it.
Yeah.
But then people take action against this, right? Which is the fascinating thing. Of course, in anthropological theory. Going back to James Scott, there's the whole idea of the state boundaries, right? And then these boundaries are kind of reified every time they're enforced, and they're created through that enforcement. Almost similarly to how we were saying that the Occupy Wall Street zone, even though it was illegal to protest there because there are so many people, right? It led this kind of ambivalency, but then the laws were enforced once it started getting cracked down.
Right.
And then it became very clear, right?
Right.
And then these things set a precedent for the future.
Mm-hmm. It's very true, right? Yeah, it's that in some ways it's a really great historical moment for a lot of young people, I think, that were paying attention to it anyway, because it was kind of the first major protest a lot of people have seen really since the 1999 WTO It's a protest in Seattle.
That's true. Especially for a lot of people who weren't alive during, you know, the civil rights protests.
Certainly, yeah.
Not such as both of us.
Yes. But it's true. So it was. I think it was a great historical moment because we did see sort of an unprecedentedness of a swelling of protest, right? But again, in the United States, anyway. I don't want to make a claim because then there's a lot more we can talk about around the world. But just for right now, in the U.S., in this specific time frame, that we were watching sort of this moment unfold that was about, you know, what is the access to space here, right? And again, as you said, there's a morality that had to do with finances too and economic systems, right? So this whole interesting tying of like the fact that this park was chosen because it's near the financial district, and then what can we use in this park? Obviously, they can't go into the buildings themselves, but one doesn't necessarily need to, right? You know, if you make the sort of the space disturbed around it, the idea I think is that it spirals outward. You can see where it's going, you know, what the intended target would be.
And also when protest areas in a place or in a space or in a public area are broken up, it's usually because there's some supposed act of violence by the protesters, right, that gets blown up and then is responded to with police violence. I mean, I was in London in 2010 when there was a massive march on the Parliament buildings, with a lot of people wearing the masks and everything, to protest the hiking of tuition. So everyone had like the 5th of November masks and that kind of thing.
Guy Fawkes, yeah,
exactly, the Guy Fawkes masks. And then the police started, physically moving everyone with their shields and batons when rumors came out that glass was being broken on the Parliament building.
Interesting.
So you always have, there has to be some kind of key thing, right, that then kind of sends this stuff out of control.
That turns it on, right, and it's a great point. And it's interesting because, I mean, again, that's in some ways becomes hearsay, in some ways violence is just part of it. But if we think about the notion of even violence itself, right, as a rupture of, I mean, it depends how you want to look at it, but in terms of we're thinking about transforming access, I mean, violence in this case can be both thought about restricting somebody from having access to something, and this we can think about that as structural violence, that, you know, people don't have access to, like, for an example of a food desert, don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables or healthy foods. You know, the closest thing in the neighborhood would be a 7-Eleven. And we can call that structural violence in the way that sort of blocks people from living to their full potential, right? And this is a much more insidious, quiet kind of violence. But thinking about this notion of transforming space then, we do see forms of violence enacted. It doesn't have to be because breaking glass or breaking bones or something, you know, is always the prerogative, right, for usually police action or crackdown against protesting movements. Mm-hmm. But again, protest movements themselves tend to come out of structural violence versus physical violence. I mean, they you can see them both. But like Occupy Wall Street, I mean, like this is based on a structural violence argument saying like the system is stacked against the way a lot of people may live, right? And that, you know, the housing bubble and all these things, you know, that major corporations or major institutions, big banks in this case, basically got away with murder, for lack of a better term. You know, some people actually may have died, depending
completely.
On like,
I mean, you think about the negative impact on the livelihoods of millions of people, losing their houses and just the complete trickle down, right? You think of all the emotional and mental stress that must have been unleashed through the collapse of the markets.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we can put this, if we want to, under the framework of this notion of structural violence, right? So that there's this interesting mix of, again, you know, access in some points has to be transformed on some levels, and that's where we see people responding. And protests oftentimes are these sort of, you know, stopping. There sometimes is a violent rupture, I think, because access has been so revoked from some people that there's a physical pushback, you know? Okay. And that's a challenge because when we're talking about protest spaces, right, of course, you know, it depends, as we're talking about Occupy, like it's legal, but it's also not legal at the same time. So there is a notion of legality and law with this in terms of like how can you also not only talk about access, but then talk about access to access, right? Or like are you allowed to then fight for access and in what ways? It's a really big challenge that, you know, there's no one answer to. But, I don't know. The question of access is it deeply penetrates a lot of the way that we even talk about our world now. I mean, even notions of open access or unaccessed journal articles or books or things that people want to read, too. I mean, it's a different topic altogether. But the notion that, you know, what do people have access to depending on what their affiliations are, right? University students could read articles maybe more easier on online databases or whatever that other people wouldn't have access to. And again, that's a little different than, you know, losing your house, but it's a lot different, but, you know, it's still these questions of like, you know, what do we, how do we talk about access, right?
Oh, completely. I mean, we had the recent, you know, the internet activist who committed suicide.
Right, Aaron Schwartz.
Aaron Schwartz, when he was downloading, you know, JSTOR articles off of the MIT server. So access is becoming, you know, just a huge issue. And even the recent net neutrality debates, right?
Yeah, still
and
going
how
on
that
too.
That all relates directly to access and the speed of access,
right
for various sites. So I think it's, especially in this day and age, I think access seems to be of the utmost importance.
Yeah.
In thinking about ways to even keep social integration with rising social inequality.
Right. It's a great point. And I think, because one of the things when we're talking about this that comes back in my head that I try to be aware of, particularly as an anthropologist in ways to think anthropologically about this, is that it can be tricky sometimes not to dive into a David and Goliath type story, right? Because it tends to feel like it's this, you know, the protesters versus the mega banks, the mega corporations, or the people versus the government, or whatever, even the government versus international governance. It doesn't matter, but it tends to see, like, I always feel like there's this, you know, or just like the people of a certain neighborhood in Chicago that when they started putting in bike lanes for a street, they ended up protesting, having to remove them because they didn't actually get community. They wanted more outreach, talking to the community of actually what they actually wanted, you know, which is fair, you know. But again, as if you're just a pure bike activist, you may say, well, that's why would they get rid of the bike lanes? You know, that isn't necessarily the point, right? So it does raise questions of even, like, we're talking about access. It's like, who's access, right? Mm. Even this notion of bike lanes. That I think you're right, that this is one of the defining features of how we talk about even, you know, our lives today, right? I think, and again, but so it's like a way to try to keep it from being David and Goliath-y, you know, that it's not always, or maybe that's one of the defining features. It seems like there's always like this mega versus this small, you know?
Oh, yeah, and even the small could be mega, right? I mean, talking about the size of the protests,
right?
And, you know, the number of people involved, right? There's, and the masses, right? So there's always, you know, various elements of the scale. It's, I think in all issues of transportation and access, right, it's always, the scale is incredible.
Yeah.
Especially just considering how many people are on the planet, right? The scales that we're dealing with
continually
seem to rise.
Right.
And then
an
interesting kind of phenomena also, right, that we're having now with the different engagements with private space is also the sharing economy, right? I know the NPR recently has been having a lot of shows and podcasts on this topic.
Mm.
But thinking about companies like Airbnb, you know, Uber,
Zipcar,
different programs that try to open up private space, almost, you know, provide access through a different format.
Right. That's what I mean. Philosopher, as well as I guess he's now German energy kind of consultant. German. He works with Germany. But Jeremy Rifkin, the philosopher, and so one of the cool things that he does. He's trying to point to the notion of the sharing economy. And one of the ideas that he points towards is that we're seeing sort of a rise of the question. Again, it's this question of access. And so he looks at Airbnb and Zipcar and talks about these as examples of ways to change how you know, we sort of engage with one another, whether it is for, you know, buying something purely for profit or changing. And he has the idea notion of the Internet of Things, we don't need to dive too much into now, but it's sort of his way of talking about the material changes that are following the philosophical differences of sharing economy. But Neil, as you point out, right, that notions like, or things like Airbnb and Zipcar are really more about access, right? It's not about owning the car. You don't need necessarily to have a house in the Hamptons, but you may want to rent a room there, right? And so again, this, what Rifkin kind of points out, that it's good to think about, we are seeing this sort of shift in a lot of people's thinking now to, again, questions of access. It's less about, you know, how do I make a buck off of this? But again, how do we, you're sort of seeing community building on top of this, right? And that, like, you know, even couchsurfing.org, or even woofing, right, which is where you travel around the world and you exchange farming labor for living somewhere and using food. It sounds very fun, you know. But again, these ideas that it's sort of access to doing different kinds of things, or having access to a car, access to a building or whatever, somewhere to stay.
Oh, yeah. And with this, right, there are so many issues involved, and especially I think how the internet can mediate and allow these relationships to develop. The fact that with so many of these different programs and companies, you have to create a user profile, right? So it's almost similar to a credit history, except that, so you're, instead of getting access to a bank loan, you know you're getting access to people's houses and, you know, being able to engage with them, and, you know, provide money in exchange for renting out their private space.
And it's important, I mean, to think about too, because One of the ideas, of course, one of the big fears with capitalism, right, is that there's this anonymity that comes with it because money has no name, right? It's just supposed to be a neutral medium, right? In which, you know, one thing is exchanged for another, and usually money is one of those two things, whether it's a service or it's a good or whatever. As you're saying, with Airbnb or Zipcar or something, right? You usually do have user profiles, and like they attach themselves some way to social media, right? And so that you actually get better ratings by people, user reviews. You know, even TripAdvisor does this too, right? And it's about sort of making community in sort of an intentional community again. Then this is, think of this as like kind of sharing versus just a pure financial transaction, right?
Oh, exactly.
It's that